From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ukraine election. Egypt's much-anticipated voting begins later today. Plus, surprising gains for far-right and far-left in European elections. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Exit polls in Ukraine show former foreign minister turned billionaire Petro Poroshenko winning Sunday's presidential election. We get more now from VOA's Al Pessin in Kyiv.
The polls conducted by several research organizations say Mr. Poroshenko received between 56 and 58% of the vote, far ahead of his nearest rival, former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, who trailed with only about 13%. Ms. Tymoshenko conceded the election in a speech Sunday night. Researchers criticized election officials for long lines that formed at some polling stations late in the day, which they blamed partly on poor organization. The pollsters said they increased the margin of error because of the lines, but not enough to change the results. Poroshenko thanked voters, particularly some who traveled from Russian-controlled Crimea to vote. Poroshenko says the first thing he will do is work to bring peace to the east. He said his first trip will be to that area. In eastern Ukraine, Russian-backed separatists have taken over some towns and public buildings and have been fighting deadly battles with government forces. Poroshenko says his next war will be against corruption and that he will deepen the country's ties to the European Union. His predecessor, Viktor Yanukovych, sparked widespread protests and a parliamentary revolt by members of his own party when he refused to sign an association agreement with the EU and signed a deal with Russia instead. Turnout was strong in most of the country, exceeding 50% in many areas. But in two eastern districts, hundreds of polling stations never opened and others had low turnouts. Monitors said separatists had intimidated both voters and election workers. In addition, clashes between separatists and government forces continued in at least one area on Sunday. Poroshenko thanked those in the region who did manage to vote. One voter in Kyiv, a student who gave his name only as Volodymyr, summarized the hopes expressed by many Ukrainians on Sunday.
I hope that these votes, they will bring us consolidation, they will bring us the needed economic new reforms that will make our country really European.
Thousands of Ukrainian and international observers monitored the election. There were no reports of serious problems except in the east. Foreign observers will make their official reports on Monday, but speaking early in the day at a Kyiv voting station, U.S. Congressman Michael Burgess had this assessment.
Everything I've seen this morning, it looks like from a policy standpoint, from a procedural standpoint, things seem to be going as well or better than would be expected.
The apparent winner, Petro Poroshenko, made his money in the candy business and has served as foreign minister and economics minister. He's pro-European, but analysts say Russian President Vladimir Putin sees him as someone he can work with. In spite of backing the separatists and keeping thousands of troops at the border, Mr. Putin said this week that he would accept the results of the Ukrainian election. Al Pessin, VOA News, Kyiv.
European Union Naval Force and the African Union on Sunday both condemned a deadly attack the government of Djibouti said involved two Somali suicide bombers. The attack occurred Saturday night when a blast detonated in a busy restaurant frequented by international soldiers. Port of Djibouti is used as a base by several militaries, including the United States, which has its only African permanent base there. Djibouti contributes troops to the African Union military force fighting militants in Somalia. And in Somalia over the weekend, Al-Shabaab militants stormed the parliament building in a bomb and gun attack that killed at least 18, including some of the attackers. VOA's Gabe Joslow has our report.
Officials say the militants set off a car bomb at the main gate of the parliament complex in central Mogadishu, where members of parliament were meeting. Witnesses say the blast was followed by several smaller explosions and gunfire. Member of parliament Hussein Arab Issa tells VOA members were listening to a speech on the floor of the assembly hall when the attack began.
All of a sudden, we just heard a loud bang, and a minute later, the gunfight ensued, and then we all tried to get out, and thank God, you know, most of us made it out.
Issa said he and fellow lawmakers were able to escape by breaking through a back wall of the dilapidated parliament building, still being repaired following years of warfare that destroyed much of the city. The attack resembles another in February targeting the presidential compound in Mogadishu, known as Villa Somalia, in which 12 people were killed, including the attackers. Somali Prime Minister Abdulwali Sheikh Ahmed praised the response of the Somali National Army and African Union peacekeepers against what he called a cowardly attack. United Nations Special Envoy to Somalia, Nick Kay, called the incident an attack against the people of Somalia for which there can be no justification. The militants have been pushed out of their major strongholds in Mogadishu and southern and central Somalia during the past 3 years under military pressure from Somali and AU forces. But the group has continued to launch targeted attacks in Somalia and has vowed to turn more of its attention to neighboring Kenya. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
After more than 3 years of turmoil, Egyptian voters are expected to elect their overwhelmingly popular former army chief, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, as the next president, hoping he will bring stability and economic growth to the country. Some activists say the election that will take place today and tomorrow is not real because the opposition has almost no chance of winning. Others say the opposition may not win, but a strong turnout by activists would emphasize their vision for the future of Egypt. Heather Murdoch reporting now from Cairo.
There is no doubt in the Egyptian capital about Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's popularity. Firecrackers go off in an area once populated by Sisi's opponents as crowds and a parade of cars bearing Sisi's posters and Egyptian flags fill the streets. Young people dance in his honor. Sisi supporters say their man is most likely to end the insecurity and choking economic problems that have afflicted Egypt since the revolution in 2011. Ahmed, a driver whose taxi displays a Sisi poster, says it is his patriotic duty to support the former military chief's presidential campaign. But on the other side of town, supporters of opposition candidate Hamdine Sabahi say the election is far more complex than that and far from over. Mohammed Adam supports Sabahi.
Lots of people think that Sisi is going to win these elections, but they are trying to support Hamdine, kind of to prove that we're here, we exist, we have a voice, we're going to vote to the opponent of Sisi.
Sabahi's supporters are not in the race to win. They want enough votes to make it clear to the government that Egyptians do not want to live under military control. Despite polls that show Sisi winning over 90% of the vote, activists say it is too soon to declare him the winner. Waving flags with the motto, "One of Us," Sabahi supporters say they do not want to choose between safety and bread. Other young Egyptians plan to ignore the election and boycott the vote altogether. Osama Malouk supports Masr al-Kawaya, a political party that attracts youth activists.
From the beginning, we told that we have a problem with the old environment, the election environment. It's been now controlled by the military.
Voter turnout has been declining in general in Egypt, at least in part because many people are tired of politics after at least 6 elections in 3 years. The authorities' crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood has also affected activist youth groups. By now, Malouk says many young Egyptians are simply despondent and uninterested in either voting or boycotting the election. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Cairo.
South African President Jacob Zuma was sworn in for a second 5-year term over the weekend at an event attended by thousands from across the country. Dozens of foreign dignitaries representing countries from across Africa attended. But on the street, South Africans expressed mixed opinions about 5 more years in office for a leader who has been embroiled in a corruption scandal after another since first taking office. Tuso Kumalo reports now from Johannesburg.
It was a spectacular and colorful ceremony as dozens of city heads of state, over 100 ambassadors representing various countries, and thousands of South Africans gathered at the union buildings in Pretoria on Saturday to witness the inauguration of President Jacob Zuma. Mr. Zuma began his second term following his ruling African National Congress's ANC 62% win in recent national elections. It was an electrifying atmosphere with both dignitaries and ordinary folks expressing excitement to witness President Zuma's second inauguration. The official ceremony began with Jacob Zuma taking the oath of office in front of the country's Chief Justice, Mokgweng Mokgweng.
I, Jacob Kedleyihlekisa Zuma, swear that I will be faithful to the Republic of South Africa, so help me God.
Then it was time for the military to salute Mr. Zuma with a 21-gun salute and a series of flybys in demonstration of their readiness to protect him and the nation at large. And in his inauguration speech, President Zuma did his best not to disappoint those who have put him in power.
This second phase will involve the implementation of radical social economic transformation.
Mr. Zuma began his final term in the midst of scandals. Parliament is set to consider a report that alleges millions of dollars in state funds were used for developments at his private rural Nkandla home. The official opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, DA, is fighting for the reinstatement of over 800 corruption, tax evasion and money laundering charges against Mr. Zuma that have been dropped. But his ruling ANC government has delivered free houses, education, electricity and social grants to millions of the poor. As a result, his inauguration attracted mixed reactions from South Africans. Elizabeth Baleni, who did not bother to attend the inauguration ceremony in Pretoria, says Zuma's second term in office spells doom for South Africa.
This will mean that more state money spent for his private businesses, or more wives at the expense of the state, and more corruption for him and his colleagues, more unemployment for youth, and a whole lot of things.
But others have showered praise on Zuma, saying his pro-poor policies have reduced poverty by a wide margin. 29-year-old Sam Mtetwa says re-electing President Zuma was the right thing to do.
I believe Zuma's installation will mean a continuity and also give him a chance to finish some of the programs which he started, which he have not completed, like the National Development Plan.
Roger Southall, a professor of sociology and political analyst at Witwatersrand University in Johannesburg, told VOA that President Zuma faces a number of challenges.
There's going to be a lot of fires to put out throughout his presidency, and it could be quite stormy. I think we'll see a continuation of the extensive protests around the country, a mixture of economic growth and continuing political difficulties.
Many say the ball is now in Mr. Zuma's court to prove his critics wrong. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
AFP reports Malawi's electoral authority said Sunday they will reopen ballot boxes after finding evidence of irregularities. The recount could start this week after an implementation plan was thrashed out on Sunday with the political parties. On Saturday, Malawi's President Joyce Banda declared the election null and void, claiming there were serious irregularities with the poll. She issued a decree that the vote counting would stop and called for fresh elections in 90 days. But just hours after her announcement, Malawi's High Court issued an injunction preventing the president from annulling the poll. Ms. Banda alleged that people had voted multiple times, ballots had been tampered with, presiding officers arrested, and the computerized voter counting system collapsed. But her main rival, Peter Mutharika, called the decision to annul the election illegal. On Sunday, electoral officials told AFP that in four districts, vote numbers did not appear to match the voting register. Heavy police presence continued on Sunday in the commercial capital, Blantyre, with scores of riot police on alert at the tally center. Still ahead on International Edition, EU elections.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Exit polls from across the European Union show surprisingly strong wins for so-called Eurosceptics on the far right and far left in European Parliament elections. The Conservative caucus, known as the EPP, was forecast to win 211 seats, enough to remain the biggest group in the European Parliament. Jean-Claude Juncker is the EPP choice for Commission President.
As we did win these elections, I feel fully entitled to become the next president of the European Commission.
French Prime Minister Manuel Valls calls Sunday's results an earthquake for Europe and France, where Marine Le Pen's far-right National Front Party was the outright winner. Nationalist parties also expected to win in Denmark and Britain. In Greece, the radical leftist coalition is poised to win. Voters in 21 of the European Union's 28 nations voted Sunday. President Obama made a brief and surprising trip Sunday to Afghanistan. Ayaz Gul has details.
President Obama met with top military commanders and addressed his troops after landing at the U.S.-controlled Bagram airfield north of Kabul. He said the war in Afghanistan has reached a pivotal point, with Afghan forces assuming primary responsibility for the country's security.
For many of you, this will be your last tour in Afghanistan. And by the end of this year, the transition will be complete, and Afghans will take full responsibility for their security, and our combat mission will be over. America's war in Afghanistan will come to a responsible end.
President Obama defended his military drawdown plans, but said a smaller American military presence in Afghanistan is needed to preserve gains the country has made over the past decade in areas such as education, health, politics and security. He praised the U.S. military for playing a central role in progress Afghans have made over the past decade.
Think about last month's election. Despite all the threats from the Taliban, the Afghan people refused to be terrorized. They registered to vote. Afghan security forces secured thousands of polling places. Then millions of Afghans lined up to cast their ballot. And next month's runoff will be another step toward the first democratic transfer of power in the history of this nation.
The Afghan presidential election was held April 5th, but none of the eight candidates won a clear majority, forcing the Election Commission to hold a runoff election June 14th between frontrunner Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani. President Obama sounded optimistic that the new Afghan president will sign a security pact with Washington that would allow a smaller U.S. military force to train and equip Afghan forces, in addition to continuing counterterrorism operations beyond 2014. Both Abdullah and Ghani have promised to approve the security deal.
With that bilateral security agreement, assuming it is signed, we can plan for a limited military presence in Afghanistan beyond 2014. Because after all the sacrifices we've made, we want to preserve the gains that you have helped to win. And we're going to make sure that Afghanistan can never again, ever, be used again to launch an attack against our country.
In his speech Sunday, President Obama said American troops have decimated the Al-Qaeda leadership in the region, while Taliban insurgents have been driven out of their strongholds in Afghanistan. But he admitted that the country is still a very dangerous place, where insurgents launch cowardly attacks against innocent civilians. Mr. Obama said he will soon announce the level of American military presence after 2014. There are 33,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, and the residual force is expected to be about 10,000 U.S. soldiers. The security agreement was to have been concluded late last year, but President Hamid Karzai refused to sign it until the United States met certain conditions. The unexpected move strained ties with the Obama administration. U.S. officials say Mr. Obama had no plans to meet President Karzai during his brief trip. A presidential statement issued in Kabul said the Afghan leader rejected an invitation extended through the U.S. embassy to meet President Obama. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Also in the news, Thailand's military leaders have warned protesters they will not tolerate any further rallies against its coup after a series of clashes between soldiers and demonstrators across the country on Sunday. Army officials say protesters would be arrested, jailed, and tried in military court. General Prayut Chan-o-cha's junta dissolved the kingdom's partly elected Senate on Saturday, one day after he named himself prime minister. Here in the U.S., Thai Americans are reacting to what's happening in Thailand. VOA's Michael Lippin spoke with Ian Asvakovith, head of the Thai Alliance in America. The group is one of the oldest Thai organizations in the U.S., founded in the early 20th century by the father of the current king of Thailand. Its mission is to help unite and empower Thai Americans in the United States. Michael asked Asvakovith if there are any signs the coup is affecting travel between the U.S. and Thailand.
Suspension of travel, I don't think so. In fact, I heard the statement that the army group had made to say that they still want to reserve the right of the foreign tourists. And, you know, there's been the coup and there's been the martial law, but it's one of the not so strict martial law. So if you feel caught on the street after a certain time, I believe 10 p.m., if you show them the passport, you still can get to where you need to go if you're a foreigner. So, you know, I think they understand that tourism is a big part of Thai economy, and they want to make sure that people that have come to visit Thailand still feel safe and they're not going to be restricted to be mobile. So for the travel side, I don't think, you know, at least for the moment, we don't see any issues with that. Now, for the economy side, in the long run, certainly there will be some impact. People who are planning a trip to Thailand are certainly going to be concerned about, you know, what's going on there. So we're hoping that, you know, this situation will get resolved and there'll be elected government back in Thailand again soon.
And what do you think is going to happen next in Thailand? And I know what you hope will happen, but what do you think is going to happen next?
Well, we've seen the coup before. The coup was in 2006. So what had happened last time is the military coup had appointed a government to run the country, and then followed by the general election. So I suspect that would follow suit again. There will be some sort of an appointment of an interim government, and there may be some reform that's done during that time, and then there will be some general election following that. So that's my suspicion. You know, one of the things that you know, doesn't get covered a whole lot is some of the story of the people that lost their lives during this protest and conflicts. I believe that people in Thailand, obviously, they're very passionate about their ideology and opinions, and I think that everyone is entitled to their opinions. But I don't believe that they should use any force or violence as a way of resolving their differences. You know, there were stories about the two kids who a brother and sister, one is 6-year-old and the other one is 4-year-old, and they were a casualty of this conflict because they were walking down the street when they had this shooting that was going on. So I believe that the Thai people should learn how to resolve the conflict in a peaceful way. Here in the United States, we obviously had a lot of conflicts and a lot of differences in our opinion with regards to the politics or the law. But we learn how to live through that together in the harmony way. So we hope that Thailand will find a way to be able to do that one day.
Ian Asvakovith, head of the Thai Alliance in America, speaking with VOA's Michael Lippin. One last thing to note, Israeli President Shimon Peres and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas have accepted Pope Francis's invitation to come to the Vatican and pray with him for peace. Speaking in the West Bank town of Bethlehem on Sunday, Pope Francis said the time had come, in his words, for everyone to find the courage to be generous and creative in ending a protracted conflict that has inflicted many wounds. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. A reminder, you can always find us on the Internet anytime at voanews.com. And we hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On May 26, 1538, the Swiss city of Geneva expelled Protestant reformer John Calvin and his followers from the town. Calvin lived in exile in Strasbourg for the next 3 years. In 1647, Elsa Young was hanged in Hartford, Connecticut, becoming the first woman to be executed as a witch in the British American colonies. Witchcraft was punishable by death in Connecticut until 1715. In 1868, the U.S. Senate came within a single vote of removing President Andrew Johnson from office. Charges were brought against the president when he illegally removed his Secretary of War from office. But the real cause of Johnson's impeachment in the U.S. House of Representatives was probably political differences that emerged after the Civil War. On this day in 1896, Wall Street Journal editor Charles Dow published the first Dow Jones Index, derived from various important American industries, a means he believed would give readers a better understanding of how the stock market was doing. More than 100 years later, stock investors still keep their eyes on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Also in 1896, Nicholas II became Tsar of Russia. The last of Russia's monarchs was forced to abdicate his throne in 1917. Nicholas and his family were later shot to death by Bolsheviks during the Communist Revolution. In 1897, the horror classic Dracula was published. The novel by Bram Stoker has been made into many movies over the years. Dracula began a public fascination with vampires that continues to this day. In 2004, Terry Nichols was found guilty of 161 state murder charges for helping carry out the Oklahoma City bombing. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has joined with other donor nations to significantly increase humanitarian assistance to the people of South Sudan. The United States is committed to meeting the immediate needs of those affected by the conflict, including more than 1.3 million people who are displaced, as we work to end the conflict and the devastating toll that it has taken. More than 50 nations gathered in Oslo, Norway on May 19th and 20th. And pledged more than $618 million in additional humanitarian aid to help those displaced inside South Sudan, as well as those who have fled to neighboring countries. Of the total, the U.S. is contributing $290.6 million. The new U.S. funds will support a variety of humanitarian aid efforts, including ramping up the distribution of food items and specialty nutrition supplements for children suffering from malnutrition, and to address a looming famine. This new assistance will also address chronic food insecurity by providing seeds, tools, and agricultural training to help South Sudanese farmers restart their livelihoods. On the health front, the new U.S. assistance will help prevent the spread of disease by providing safe drinking water, latrines, and training on safe hygiene practices. Emergency health services will be expanded, both in South Sudan and in neighboring countries that are hosting refugees from the conflict. Construction of camps and nutrition programs will be aided in those nations as well. That said, the new U.S. assistance and that of our international partners can only be effective if the parties to the conflict stop their fighting and remove all obstacles to the delivery of this life-saving effort. It is crucial that both sides implement the May 9th agreement to end the violence and allow immediate, full, and unconditional access to the United Nations and humanitarian organizations to reach those in need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.